And welcome to End Credits. We're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me is...
Vince Masson. Thank you for having me.
And Vince's first time on the show, though you are one of the originators, but this is your first time doing the show, so welcome, Vince. And,
Thank you.
We look forward to hearing your opinions. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. You can listen to us here on CFRU every Wednesday at 8 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the action horror movie universe originator, The Mummy. That's it, the back half of the show. For the first half, we will talk about some of the things that have been making the news this week. And that includes the future of filmmaker Neil Blomkamp. His last movie bombed, he lost his chance to make an Alien movie, now he's talking about making a sequel to this first best film, and where will this talented director go next? And then we will talk about the hype around Top Gun 2. Tom Cruise can't stop talking about it. Val Kilmer says he's ready for it, but is the world really clamoring for more Top Gun? But first, the controversy around the last year's rebooted Ghostbusters, it just won't die, oddly enough, and perhaps ironically enough, I'm not sure. It's a ghost that keeps coming back, maybe apropos given the material. But if you didn't see the news, you had Dan Aykroyd, who was the co-star and the co-writer of the first two Ghostbusters movies. He jump-started the debate again. He accused Paul Feig, who made the reboot, of not following his advice. His advice meaning Aykroyd, it sounded like, and thus, you know, it seemed to be diving back into the whole debate of whether or not that was a good idea, rebooting Ghostbusters. So, Vince, I'll throw it to you first. What did you think of the all-female Ghostbusters last year? And what do you think of Dan Aykroyd doing some smack talk? There we go. Spit it out.
Well, it's interesting. I actually did not see the newest Ghostbusters, so I can't really comment on the artistic integrity of that film.
Mm-hmm.
I did see what Dan Aykroyd was saying,
mm-hmm.
and I think it would actually be interesting to get the sound clip of that, because he was on a talk show, I believe.
Yeah, he was on Sunday Brunch, which is on Britain's Channel 4.
Right.
Yeah.
And I forget how the whole thing was initiated, but he kind of went into a tirade about Paul Feig and basically said that he spent too much money on the film, and that was, or at least contributed to its failure.
Yeah.
Let me just say this. I actually think that's despicable, what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very classic game that they like to play out in Hollywood, which is point the fingers at somebody when things don't go their way.
Right.
I listened to the tape. I saw the video. And I got to say, he just sounds like a bitter man. He sounds very bitter. He sounds bitter because his film didn't make as much money as he wanted it to. And now he's pulling what David Fincher experienced after Alien 3, which is everybody was on the bleachers cheering you on beforehand. And then when it didn't go well, everyone points the finger and says, there's that guy that is responsible. And the fact that Paul Feig was not even there to defend himself, I think, is a little unfair. I also think that I was just kind of confused by some of the things that he was saying. He was like, we told him to do the reshoots. He didn't want to do the reshoots. And then he later found out that he had to do the reshoots, which cost us an extra like $40 million or whatever.
Yeah, which was about 10 times what Sony came out and said was the cost of the reshoots. Yeah.
And just these little like he was saying, you know, well, Sony doesn't like to lose money. It's like, okay, well,
what else is new?
Yeah, no movie studio likes to lose money. Like, what are you talking about? And I think there was a more professional way to handle your losses, saying, listen, Paul Feig is a very talented guy. You know, his track record speaks for itself. We didn't make the kind of numbers that we wanted to make on this film, but you know, we still are proud of the film, and we are proud of the work that Paul did. That would have been, I think, a professional way to handle that. But instead, he totally threw him under the bus and said, well, he's not going to be back on the studio lot anytime soon.
Yeah.
And he just sounded very bitter. And I lost a lot of respect for him. I've always been kind of indifferent about Dan Aykroyd as an actor, whatever. But that seems a little excessive. I think anybody that has made a film or has tried to make a film knows how ridiculous that is to point the fingers like that.
Well, it's a group effort, right? And you know this because you're a filmmaker.
Yes.
There are so many things to unpack. I did like your Alien comparison because there is a comparison, because Alien 3 was in production for years and years and years with like various scripts and various iterations and various creative teams on it. And so was Ghostbusters. I think the bitterness of Dan Aykroyd was that he thought this was going to launch, like bring Ghostbusters back. It would make $1 billion and prove that, you know, there's more Ghostbusters fervor out there than, you know, perhaps he'd estimated. If you look at the film, and I did see the film, I actually have a soft spot.
What did you think of the film, actually?
It's fun.
Okay.
It's fun. It's nothing special. The women in it, the four women, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Leslie Jones, Kay McKinnon, I thought they had great chemistry together. The film works when it just lets them riff off each other. Mm-hmm. The film doesn't work whenever it has homages to the first Ghostbusters, whenever it has an explicit ripped off scene from the Ghostbusters, when it has one of the cameos from one of the Ghostbusters. And and somebody made this point, I was listening to a podcast this week, Dan Aykroyd's cameo I think is the worst cameo in it, because he actually says the line, I ain't afraid of no ghosts in it. And I don't know if that was like somebody else's idea or if it was his idea, like, well, I've got to say the line because I co-wrote the original Ghostbusters.
He pulled a Tarantino there. He's got to give himself that little that little bit just to put himself on screen.
That may be giving Dan Aykroyd too much credit. But the whole he's not welcome on the studio lot thing, it's like, well, first of all, Paul Feig has got, on the one hand, he's got Ghostbusters. On the other hand, he's got Bridesmaids, The Heat, and Spy. That's like Paul Feig's last 10 years. What was Dan Aykroyd's last 10 years?
Yeah, that's the thing. And the other interesting thing that he brings up is, and it was a very small part of the video, he was like, we tested it, and then we needed additional reshoots. Again, I'm sorry, I don't know it verbatim, but he mentioned the test screenings. And then following the test screenings, that's when it was confirmed they needed it.
Which more or less happens on every major Hollywood movie.
Yeah. And they give, as far as I'm concerned, way too much credence to this test screening whole protocol thing.
Yeah.
It was funny. I was listening to Paul Thomas Anderson talking about this. He was saying in 1994, they were rebooting Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah.
And that tested like 100%. Positive, like it was perfect all across the board. And then of course it goes on to bomb, and the reason is because no one wants to say no to Santa Claus,
right?
So it's the system is, and Steven Soderbergh was saying this about Magic Mike too. Magic Mike tested horribly, for test audiences. Like it's he was saying, you know, it's worth considering, but it should not be the be all end all for a film.
Right.
So I don't know what he's talking about when he says, you know, like after that could mean anything. It could mean that it was sitting at a 6 out of 10, and then after the test screenings it was like, okay, it could be a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
I don't really know. Again, I don't like the fact that Paul Feig was not there to explain his side of the story.
Yeah, the test screening thing is so interesting because the way that it is, they just kind of like are out in the street like saying, you want to come and see this movie and rank it. You know, there's really no kind of, you know, science behind it. It's just like whoever can come to a screening at, you know, 2 p.m. on a Monday or 7 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Right.
And it's one thing to be offered free tickets to go to a test screening of Miracle on 34th Street, but another thing to go to the public and say, here's another version of Miracle on 34th Street. Do you want to see it today? And you know, there's a difference between like being offered free tickets to see something and then offering people the opportunity to go see something. And you know, you can't be terribly surprised given the different circumstances that things turn out the way they do sometimes.
Definitely. And I think, sorry to make this a Steven Soderbergh thing, but I like a lot of what he says. And he's very critical of the system, the studio system that's happening now. Right. I think it's worth kind of reflecting on that and contemplating these failures a little bit more. It's not a case of, well, people just didn't want to see this. Now let's move on to the next thing. I think there's a lot of logic in trying to figure out why things work or don't work. But I just think the way that he handled it, which was completely throw him under the bus, was quite despicable, as I said.
Yeah, and on top of it all, Dan Aykroyd was out before the film saying it has more laughs and more scares than the first two Ghostbusters. So it's what a difference a year makes.
And then, some executive probably, you know, oh, that Paul Feig, if he had just listened to us about the reshoots. And then, you know, who knows? He might have been reconfiguring his opinion about the whole thing.
Right, and I'll finish this out by saying this. You know, if you go back and read the development of how Ghostbusters was developed, it was originally Dan Aykroyd's idea, and he worked with Ivan Reitman and Harold Ramis. But of course, Dan Aykroyd is like super into the paranormal and the supernatural. So his script was like filled with all this esoteric garbage and world building that was completely unnecessary. And what Harold Ramis did on the screenplay was basically throw all that off and get back to the character and the comedy, which is, I think, what a lot of people remember. A lot of people don't remember, like, how a proton pack works. Who gives a crap? But a lot of people remember, you know, we came, we saw, we kicked its ass. And that's, I think that was from Ghostbusters, too. No, it was from the first Ghostbusters. But it's a lot of people remember the lines more than the jargon about, you know, where Gozer comes from and
sure,
that kind of thing.
Sure, absolutely,
Speaking of honest opinions about one's own work. Neil Blomkamp was doing some round of interviews this week. He started a little, I don't know if you call it a micro studio, or, you know, he's making some short films. It's called Oat Studio, and he's doing these experimental sci-fi genre kind of films. But he was talking about his last film, Chappie, which was not a success at the box office. Chappie, the tale of, I don't know, two a-holes and a robot.
That's I think that was the IMDb summary, actually.
So it just seems to me that he probably might have something to apologize for. But it's interesting to sort of read his comments about how his intention was to create something that, you know, was less focused on the nitty gritty sort of, I guess, again, the esoteric or the debate and the philosophy of AI, and just tell something that was kind of crazy. I think he succeeded on that point, but I don't think his vision was fully realized, which I think was the point he was trying to get at with that interview. I think it was with Digital Spy.
Yeah, and just to further that, he was saying this was like Elysium. I can kind of live with that failure because it wasn't.
Yeah, I can
totally
live with it too.
The kind of vision that I had.
Yeah,
but Chappie was exactly the movie that like he wanted to make, and I think he was bummed that people didn't. He didn't have an immediate kind of answer for why it was not well received.
Yeah,
I personally did not like the film, but I did admire what he was trying to do, and I admire him as a filmmaker enormously.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy that obviously likes to make movies that you kind of start and then, you know, they're thrilling kind of from beginning to end. And then he throws in some kind of social themes in there that I think are really good. So I really admire what he was going for, I guess, but the film didn't really work for me, I have to say. But that being said, I think District 9, enough time has passed. I think that movie came out in the summer of 2009, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Enough time has passed where we're sitting here in 2017 that, you know, we've seen the reputation of that film kind of grow enormously. I think it's now considered to be one of the great, like, sci-fi movies.
Yeah, I'd agree. I remember the summer that came out because I was like in Toronto twice a week for a job, and you know, in the subway they had the posters up, you know, the aliens not allowed in this area.
They had a very clever like marketing.
It was really clever, yeah. And I think that's what drew a lot of people in, but then the movie itself was very rewarding. I think, like you said, what he does really well is mix a social message with sci-fi action material, mm-hmm. which is kind of the origin of science fiction, going back to Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and those. They were making often very pointed social commentary in their books. I think where it's gone off the rails, you're right about Elysium. I can kind of live with it. I see its faults, but I can live with it. I can look at it as like an ambitious, like sort of sophomore slump failure kind of deal.
Right.
But with Chappie, he was throwing all these ideas at the wall to see what was, and it was not helped at all by D. Antwerp.
Right.
I don't know their music, but just like from public comments from them, they seem like really sort of abrasive and off, which I guess is kind of their image. But I they're not the type of, I want to say actors, but I don't think they were really acting in that movie. They're not the kind of characters you want to build a movie around, I think.
Right.
I wonder if it would have been different if he just like used D. Antwerp as like kind of inspiration for two like South African punk jerks and had like actual actors play the parts.
Yeah.
If that would have helped, I'm not sure it would have entirely helped with everything he wanted to do with Chappie, but I'm sure it would have, you know, just when you watch Chappie, and you can go and watch it on Netflix right now, actually, just the Antwerp is like a black hole down which all your attention goes whenever they're on screen.
I think he was, like, they are a South African music group. He's South African. I think he obviously, I think he kind of underestimated how, you know, audiences would appreciate those things. You know, maybe a bit of his own kind of personal admiration for them crept in there.
Mm.
I don't know. I can't watch Elysium without going, like, if you had just taken another year, 6 months, and fleshed out this script, it would have been fantastic. It would have been great. Why did you settle for what it is, which I think is kind of ho-hum?
And that's why I think Oats is interesting, the Oats Studio project, because where did District 9 come from? It came from a short film.
Right.
So if he's sort of like playtesting concepts for future feature films, and he's doing it in the form of short... I mean, it kind of sounds like he's doing his own thing with this, but at the same time, it would make sense for him to say, well, what made District 9 different? Well, I kind of took it for a test drive in this shorter effort. What if I, you know, I have all these ideas. I'll take some of them for a test drive, see what sticks. They're not all going to be A's, mm-hmm. but if I'm looking for future feature ideas, it makes sense for me to take them for that test drive first as a short film.
Which is also why I'm slightly worried about what he's saying about coming back to District 9. I don't think he's making a sequel necessarily, but he's just kind of coming back
to
that world.
He said it's like in the world, yeah. So
I'm just worried that he's going back to that to try and reclaim that success rather than some passionate kind of artistic vision that he has for that. So I'm of course totally up for another Blomkamp film in general, but definitely anything District 9 related. I'm a little apprehensive about why he's doing it.
I'm apprehensive generally about anything like going back to the District 9 well, whether it's in the world or if it's a sequel, because I do think that the way that movie ends is sort of like it's a perfect little one-off.
Definitely.
It has a beginning, middle, and end. I don't need to see what happens to I forget his name. Copley. I don't need to see what happens to his character next. But I'm also at the same time glad he's not moving on to an alien movie, because I think that got way out of hand way too fast, because he released on Instagram this, like, I don't know if he was like just sort of farting around with alien, like, what would Alien 5 look like if I made it today? And then it got way out of hand and like, we're going to green light this. And then Chappie comes out and kind of throws it off course. And then Ridley Scott says, well, I have ideas for 10 alien films. So buzz off. But whatever happens with Alien next, I'm glad that he's not going to be involved in Alien. He should stick with his own movies. He should stick with his own ideas. He just needs to sort of, I guess, you know, brainstorm a bit more, maybe, you know, try to get into inside his own mind in terms of why District 9 worked and why other movies have not.
Yeah. At the same time, I wonder why Ridley Scott would be so apprehensive to let a young kind of fresh voice do another installment in that franchise. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the films are entertaining, but I'm a little more curious about what Neil Blomkamp, he seemed very, very excited about doing that film. And I think all of that Instagram kind of attention was just a testament to how passionate he was about that film.
Man.
And I was thinking, like, why not give him a crack at it? Like, you know, like, obviously Ridley Scott has some kind of emotional ties to that series.
Yeah.
But I would be very curious to see what he could do.
I think after Alien Covenant, we'd all rather see Ridley Scott move on to other things. But
yes.
Speaking of moving on, Tom Cruise apparently cannot. There's been a lot of talk lately about Top Gun 2, or as Tom Cruise has coined it, Top Gun : Maverick. I can't help but wonder, Vince, and maybe you might feel the same. I feel like there was an interview he did with Entertainment Tonight where he's like, oh yeah, there's going to be fighter jets, and it's going to be dogfights, and there's going to be volleyball. And it just from the sound of it, this is like that's something that's gotten away from him. Like, he brought it up on like an Australian show, and then everyone was like, okay, Top Gun 2 is coming.
Yes.
And now he's like furiously trying to catch up to the hype. And, you know, I may be misreading that. There may be a genuine Top Gun Maverick in the works, but I can't help but think that this is another figment of Tom Cruise's imagination.
Yeah. And I can't help but feel like they would do a lot of what you were talking about with Ghostbusters, throwing in those kind of glib like references to the first one, that kind of wink wink to everybody, which I'm starting to get really like annoyed with. But the other thing that I was thinking about with Top Gun is like the world is just kind of a different place than it was in 1986 when that film came out. I don't know how much fun I would have seeing these dogfights and these volleyball games and whatever else he's talking about.
Right.
It's like the reality is, you know, that stuff means, I think, something different now.
Yeah.
The fighter jets and all of that. So I don't see how they could do that without alluding to some of the political stuff that's been going on.
That's a great point, because you make Top Gun 10 years sooner and it's like completely insensitive because you're just coming off Vietnam. But enough time had passed where America wasn't involved like explicitly in a war effort. It was a couple of years after the Falklands and Grenada and, you know, sort of like wars that weren't really wars. And then, so, you know, it kind of hit that area where you could sort of romanticize being a fighter jock and being in the military. And I think it's very different now, like you said, because one of the things we're talking about is making it about drones. And talk about political, you know, who's going to want to sit there and watch a movie about like, woo, we're flying drones, it's kick-ass. And, you know, especially in the wake of, there was a movie called Drone, which was, again, about, you know, the politics and the human cost of drone. Eye in the Sky last year, which was a great movie about drone warfare.
And there was one with Ethan Hawke as well called Good Kill.
That's right. I'm glad you remembered that third one. I couldn't remember it. But, I mean, none of those movies are about how kick-ass it is to be a drone pilot. It's, you know, it's about, you know, the people on the ground and, you know, they never see it coming and how, you know, there's all these civilian casualties and
how removed people are from the war,
right.
You are, like, putting your crosshairs over somebody and then you're leaving your office and grabbing a coffee afterwards.
Exactly.
Like, that's the kind of war that they're engaged in. So I without making it too political, I don't see how they could get away with not mentioning the conflicts that are going on.
Yeah. The other thing too is that they're talking about Joseph Kosinski as maybe being the director, and he's done Tron Legacy and Oblivion. He worked with Tom Cruise on Oblivion, and these are both like incredibly good looking movies, which of course any Top Gun movie would have to be.
Right.
But they're fairly empty. They're fairly soulless. They're kind of void.
And I remember William Monahan, who wrote The Departed, was saying, like, I thought I had a great sci-fi script with Oblivion, and what he did with that movie was nothing like what I wanted.
Right.
So I don't know if that's just his shtick, but I'm, you know what? And it's like Val Kilmer too.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer is like the Dan Aykroyd of that movie. It's like, what have you done? I shouldn't say that. Okay, he was really good in the Bad Lieutenant with Nicolas Cage. But
that movie cannot be underestimated. I love that movie. But go on.
But other than that, like I'm not rushing out of my house to see Val Kilmer's return to that.
And you're right. And a lot of people were wondering, like, do we want to see Val Kilmer? Like, can he fit into a jumpsuit anymore? Which is why he put that selfie online. And like, look, I am ready. I am good to go. Yeah. Because he's, you know, not to be, you know, body shaming, but he's been fairly chubby the last couple of years.
He'll have to be in the command post, maybe giving the orders.
Maybe, but I mean, he sounds like he's ready to roll. And
or he's the guy with the sticks on the runway, like...
Iceman. It's like, I used to be Iceman, now I'm Stickman. But yeah, I can't. Tom Cruise was saying like it's going to be like happening next year, and I can't imagine this is going to happen in a year.
No.
Like, first of all, Tony Scott, the original director, is dead.
That's true.
I can't imagine this happening without him. The last kind of official word about this was a tweet from Jerry Bruckheimer like a year ago, and Jerry Bruckheimer's stock isn't fairly high right now because like his last movie was the last Pirates movie, and not a lot of people, you know, leaving that one excited. And then, you know, on top of it all, they're talking about like bringing Harold Faltermeyer back, and they're talking about like having a volleyball scene, and you know, Tom, that was actually mentioned in an interview with Tom Cruise. He's like, oh yeah, there's gonna be a volleyball scene. It's like, are you not aware of the homoerotic connotations that have been assigned to that in the last 30 years? Are you like meta aware? Like, if you thought that volleyball scene was homoerotic, wait until you get a load of this.
Until John Krasinski gets. Yeah, his hands on this.
I'm not sure. Again, it just feels like this is something that's like a monster he created, and it's gotten away from him, and he's trying desperately to say, no, I meant to create this monster because I have all these ideas, and they're all just doing what we did in Top Gun 1.
Is Top Gun on Netflix?
It's been good a question. Long time since I've seen that. I think it is.
I'm curious to rewatch it. It's been so long.
I haven't watched it probably since high school. It's just not.
Okay. We're both due for a rewatch.
We're due for a rewatch. And it's sort of been on my mind even before Tom Cruise was talking about redoing Top Gun. But yeah, it's something I think worth looking back upon. And I do believe it is on Netflix, or at least it was recently, but that's neither here nor there. Right. We do have another Tom Cruise movie in mind coming up next, and it is The Mummy. And I was thinking about The Mummy. I was thinking about music that we could play for today's show. So thinking about The Mummy, I thought, Mother, Mother. And so this is Mouth of the Devil by Mother, Mother. It is from their 2017 album, No Culture. And speaking of No Culture, we will review The Mummy next. You're on End Credits. This is CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Welcome to Prodigium, Mr. Morton. from the Latin, monstrum vel prodigio, a warning of monsters.
Forgive the state of things, we had very little time to prepare for our guest, and only the information Jennifer provided to go on.
In truth, she works for us. It's not an exact science, this business.
And the business being?
Evil, Mr. Morton. Recognize, contain, examine, destroy. She is by far the most ancient we've ever encountered.
And that was The Mummy, the new action horror monster movie from Universal Studios. It stars Tom Cruise, Annabelle Wallace, Sophia Botella, and Russell Crowe. Is directed by Alex Kurtzman, and it is the start of what's being billed as the Dark Universe. And
co-written by Christopher McQuarrie, interestingly enough, who won an Oscar for writing The Usual Suspects in 1995.
I do wonder, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, this whole idea of the Dark Universe, we're going to take Dracula and Frankenstein and the Mummy and the Wolfman. And,
so that's what they're planning on doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So The Usual Suspects.
True.
The Usual Horror Suspects.
Christopher McQuarrie, yeah, that's why they called him in.
But yeah, it's funny because, you know, when you see at the beginning where it does the Universal coming around the Earth and then it flips over and it's like Dark Universe. And I'm like, really, like right off the top, this is a thing. Because I do wonder how many people in like you who are like sitting there like Dark Universe. What the F?
I had a vague idea that they were going to do that, but it kind of threw me off.
Yeah. So what did you think of The Mummy? I don't know what your level of like sort of mummy engagement is. There's of course the 30s version with Boris Karloff. There's the Brendan Fraser mummy movies from the 90s. And
they're all kind of different in their own way. I do remember seeing the Brendan Fraser mummy in 1999, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty young at the time, but I remember having like a lot of fun with that movie. And even to this day, I consider The Mummy, the Stephen Sommers Mummy, like one of the best like bad movies ever, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just, it belongs in that category.
It's a guilty movies. Pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. So I was expecting something similar from this. And I have to say, it was just bad. Like it was not even bad on like an entertaining level. I just like thought it was really bad.
Right. I was kind of moderately entertained. I was never like sometimes in a bad movie, like they get a scene right or a couple of scenes right. I don't think there was a scene that like kind of got my attention or got me to like really see the potential of this. I think there were like some huge problems with tone because there's like there's a lot of humor in it and then it goes to something horrific. Like in the beginnings, there's like bugs and rats and then it cuts to, you know, Tom Cruise talking to his like dead friend who's like been zombified or something, and they're like talking in the bathroom mirror and the friend's played by Jack Johnson, who's well known for a comedic TV show, it's played for laughs. It's like some kind of Shaun of the Dead, and then it goes back to the street where he's being stalked by Sophia Botella's mummy.
It takes itself so seriously sometimes. And that's what the 1999 one for me, like that's why it was so much fun, because it didn't.
It was tongue in cheek.
Yes, and in terms of horror, I really just did not find it that scary.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that bothered me was like the bugs and the rats crawling on in those scenes, because I mean that's like a visceral kind of like natural reaction to the idea of bugs crawling on you, and nobody likes that. And then there's a scene in Prodigium, which that was the clip we played, is Russell Crowe playing Nick Fury, I mean Henry Jekyll, introducing Tom Cruise to this Prodigium world where they hunt monsters, and there's a scene where a bug crawls on the ear of one of the techs at Prodigium, and because the mummy's taking him over, and that's like a that's a creepy crawling moment, because you don't want bugs crawling in your ear. But other than that kind of like visceral kind of horror just sort of natural reaction to seeing bugs on screen crawling in people's crevasses. It's not that scary.
It's not, and it moves at such a breakneck pace. Like, it's so determined to keep you engaged.
Yeah.
And to, like, just keep you on the edge of your seat, that it's like some of it just seems absurd and very excessive. I was like, can we just slow it down for a bit and, like, just establish some of these characters? So I think the general premise, I saw it last night to keep it fresh in my mind, and now all I want to do is, like, not have it in my mind. But I think the premise was Tom Cruise was this – I think he was in the military.
Yeah.
And he...
Yeah, Jack Johnson calls him Sarge.
Okay. Yeah. And they search... They're in Iraq, and yeah, they're searching for these kind of... what's the word?
Antiquities.
Yes.
Yeah.
These ancient antiquities that the insurgents are, like, destroying. And then he stumbles on... The
mummy's tomb.
Mummy, yeah, that unleashes. So it's very loosely like the 1999 one, but that was the other thing. They, like, started in Iraq. They're doing, like, these firefights with these insurgents, and I'm like, is this going to be referenced in any kind of, like, responsible social way? Like, is this conflict gonna mean anything? But it's not. I think they just threw it in there because it's timely and they wanted to, like... But I was like, you know what? I'm tired of this conflict being turned into, like, you know, the guys with the head, like, scarves, and they're in these pickup trucks and whatever.
Yeah.
It's like... Can we do something a little bit more authentic? Can we?
Yeah.
But
I hear
but
you
again,
on that.
I don't see why it had to have the Iraq stuff.
Yeah. I hear you on that. But and this is, like, one of the things that bother me. It's like crawling along the edges are these interesting ideas. Like, you know, it actually doesn't start in Iraq. It starts in medieval England.
True. Yes.
Right. Where they're burying the jewel that she needs to conquer the world. And it starts with this idea, like, that, you know, there's stuff buried all over London. I guess it calls back to, like, when they found Richard III buried in a parking lot a couple of years ago. That idea that, like, there's all these, like, hidden worlds and hidden temples and crevasses and tombs, you know, sort of in all over the ancient world, or places that, you know, were around in the ancient world, it plays into the whole dark universe idea that there's this underworld we don't know about. That was interesting, but, you know, it's sort of it's a footnote. Going to Iraq and then seeing, I guess they are basically ISIS fighters, because you see them, you know, shooting up ancient statues and stuff, which is what ISIS does. ISIS destroys anything that predates, you know, Muhammad and Islam. That's an interesting idea.
That was interesting. And I want to be clear that I thought it was interesting
if there had been any point to it, other than to just have Tom Cruise and Jack Johnson,
like, here's
be
what's in the news now. And, like, and again, that's why the Brendan Fraser one was so entertaining. They just set it in the 1930s. Let's not even go the political route. Let's just, you know, let's just have fun out there.
Of course, there was a there was a Muslim character in that film who is like fully three-dimensional and not, you know, a caricature.
In the 1999
Oded,
one?
Yeah, the Oded Fehr, who's like one of the protectors, like one of the guardians to make sure nobody digs up the mummy.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, that's kind of an interesting point too. And I noticed we haven't talked about the mummy herself, which I do think is one of the successful aspects of the film, because I think Sophia Boutella is, like, she's a wonderful physical performer. You know, you see her in Kingsman, you see her in Star Trek Beyond, you see her in this. You know, she's acting with her body as much as, like, her face and her voice and things. She's incredibly dexterous, very magnetic. But I feel like maybe she was kind of wasted here too.
Yeah, and they tried to do, like, this very kind of loose romance type thing,
yes,
where she's not quite a villain the way that the mummy was in the other ones.
Yeah.
but she's kind of seducing him in a way, and he's having these daydreams, and there's a lot of these dream sequences.
Yeah.
So she wasn't quite as villainous and like evil as I think the other ones, but I agree. It was a very nice change of pace.
Yeah.
To her performance. I had never seen her in anything else, I'll be perfectly honest.
Well, no, and that's, I mean, I think she's not a household name. I think she probably might be one of these days. You know, she's not playing like side character. I think this would have been the perfect opportunity to make her a household name. But c'est la vie. The romance thing really kind of irked me because I was thinking about it last night after seeing the movie. I can't really think of a romantic partner in a Tom Cruise movie that sort of he has like kind of like genuine chemistry with.
Right.
He's not like, I mean, in so much as Tom Cruise is like a handsome man and he's been in like sort of leading man romantic interest parts before. I can't really think of an actress he's had like really great chemistry with, up to and including former wives and girlfriends on screen.
Yeah.
And the thing of it is here, he's kind of like a dual romantically. There's this kind of like bizarre love triangle with the Annabelle Wallace archaeologist character and
so
the
weird
Sophia Boutella character. And it's like he has no chemistry with either of them. And it, like when there are these scenes where he goes into like these like fugue state flashback things where he sees her as she was in ancient Egypt. And, you know, she's all beautifully made up. And he has this look in his face like, what's going on? I don't get it. Right? You know, there's no look on his face like, maybe you can seduce me. I kind of dig what you're selling here. And it doesn't work at all. And I almost find it problematic, the whole basis of it, which is that, you know, she's been given superpowers by the god of death. And, you know, in order to, like, sort of ferment their pact, she has to sacrifice a mortal man. And it seems, and there's a whole kind of like, it's not just enough for me to sacrifice you. I have to seduce you and straddle you and finger your chest and lick you. And then I'll stab you and turn you into the god of death. And then I guess we'll live happily ever after. I don't know there's an element of like sexualizing the mission that that sort of rubs me the wrong way, especially after last week you were talking about Wonder Woman and how there was such tremendous efforts to not sexualize her.
Right. Yeah.
And then this week we have the Mummy, and you know, she's not just selling like death from above. She's going to make you like want it sexually before death comes.
Yeah. And I was not familiar with the other romantic interest as well.
Annabelle Wallace, she's kind of new.
Okay.
She's done a lot of like British TV. I think people might know her best from the Annabelle, the Conjuring spinoff, Annabelle.
Okay.
Which,
I did actually see that, but I don't remember.
I only saw it recently. And it's, I mean, I love the Conjuring movies, but Annabelle is sort of typifies everything you probably hate about modern horror movies, but considering where it comes from. But
there's a lot of like cheap jump scares in this movie as well.
Oh, yeah.
So many.
Yeah. It's, I want to talk about Prodigium because it's I call it the Iron 2 curse, the Iron Man 2 curse, where you know, everybody is involved is so emphatic and in love with creating this deeper world that they forget that they're actually making a movie that has a beginning, middle, and end.
Yes.
Because if you go back and look at the first Iron Man, there's a couple of Easter eggs, like Phil Coulson's in a couple of scenes. But that's it. Nobody's talking about it. Nobody says the A word in it.
And he becomes like, there's a clear transition.
It's about him becoming Iron Man. It's not about him joining S.H.I.E.L.D. or the Avengers. It's Tony Stark becoming Iron Man.
Yeah.
And every other scene in this movie seems to be, because again, to reference back to that scene where Tom Cruise is brought into Prodigium, which is under the Natural History Museum, which was kind of a cool touch, but he's brought in and he's going past all these like row upon rows of artifacts, and there's like the vampire skull in formaldehyde, and there's a Gillman hand, which I guess is a reference to Creature from the Black Lagoon, and he's being led around by this guard, and this guard is kind of looking, it's from Tom Cruise's POV, and the guard looks back at him, so the guard's looking back at the audience, and it's kind of like a tacit like, huh, see what we got coming up, check it out. And then we finally get to Russell Crowe, who's Henry Jekyll. And of course, we have to have a scene where he turns into Hyde, and it just feels so tacked on. It's like, of course, he's gonna turn into Hyde.
And he was the one that was like, "This movie, they're trying to scare you." Before this movie came out, he was like emphasizing that it was going to be a scary movie.
Yeah,
it's like your scenes were the least scary of any of them.
I don't know. I like that the fact that he didn't turn into like a CGI blob when he turns into Hyde. That was nice. He comes like this orange colored cockney, which I made me think of Trump for obvious reasons. But there was an interesting touch because when he turns into Hyde, that they have this procedure where they like seal him off from the rest of the.
Yeah.
And he's fighting Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise knows that his handprint opens the door. So he shoves his hand against the palm scanner, and it comes up at E. Hyde, not H. Jekyll. And I thought that was kind of that was a very neat touch. I just wish, again, it plays into this, the whole thing with the film is like there are so many interesting ideas that you wish they would pick one and just roll with it. I could have waited for the Jekyll and Hyde movie to see something like that, or I could have waited for like a Creature from the Black Lagoon movie to see the Gillman again. Just like tell me a really awesome mummy movie, and then, you know, at the end have some, or have these things on the side, or like have Henry Jekyll come in at the end and goes, "Oh, by the way, if you thought that was effed up, wait until you see what else we've got."
Yeah.
And then that's a great way to get you into other things, all these
like
other
Shyamalan
things.
Shyamalan just did with Split.
With Split, yeah, exactly.
I'm weary. Like, I didn't really like the modern, like, context of the movie either. I just... It felt just inherently like weird to be in these like big kind of metropolis,
yeah.
And these like this technology, but they're dealing with this like ancient stuff, and then it's clearly stuff that that belongs in an older time period, but they're trying to make it. It just like didn't feel right to me. I know that's a very like kind of vague way to say it, but
no, right?
It just kind of. I don't know.
But that was the sneaky genius of those Summers movies when he put them in the 1920s and 1930s,
yep.
Is because, you know, it's a kind of modern time, but at the same time, there are still, you know, when you're in the 1920s, there are people around who remember, you know, the Civil War firsthand, to remember, you know, when trains weren't a thing, when cars weren't a thing. So, you know, there's a very old world meets new world quality in that time. Versus today, which is all new world, and you know, you see, you know, guys,
it's like,
and
ultra realistic or
yeah,
something.
It would have been interesting if there had been like some way to, I don't know, again, I think that's all about, you know, creating the universe. You know, we can't have a mummy movie set in, you know, the 1940s and then Dracula set in the 19
right.
or the 1890s or what have you, and I think that's a compromise they had to make because they're trying to create the dark universe.
With that being said, they still could have made a better modern,
yes, of course,
mummy movie.
If they'd stayed in the desert, I think if they had stayed in, you know, Egypt or the Middle East, and just like that's kind of where the mummy, like to have the mummy wandering around like midtown London.
Yeah, it really loses its steam like after he gets back from Iraq, and that kind of that thing that was propelling the movie,
yeah,
just kind of comes to a halt. And there's so much like exposition. It's just, you know, that sorry, I've forgotten her name already, but
oh, Annabelle Wallace.
She's just like telling everybody the plot all the time, and that thing that they're after is just like a total, what Alfred Hitchcock used to call a MacGuffin. It's
yeah.
It does not serve any purpose in the story other than to be something that the characters can like chase after. That's what that like gem or whatever they were after was.
And there's a whole like flashback at the beginning explaining, I think her name is Aminette, the mummy, how she became the mummy and how she got her powers and what happened to her and all that. And then like 20 minutes later, that's revealed as Tom Cruise starts seeing these, or Nick Morton, I think his character's name is he starts seeing the flashbacks and he starts like encountering her. Like there had to have been some way where you could like combine the two. Like it's there's just a real fault of storytelling here.
Yeah. And, I don't know if you saw it in 3D. I saw it in 3D
because I did see
that
it in 3D.
Was the showing, and there was maybe one sequence. I'm getting like so tired of 3D, honestly, and I think it's the physical. It's having those glasses physically on my face right. is starting to bother me because I find they're just like at a distance on my nose where it feels too far away.
Yeah,
but I can't push them up any further. Anyway, it's just like starting to bother me, but. What I would say is I would pass on The Mummy. I would not like I would not waste your money on The Mummy. However, for everybody who is criticizing Tom Cruise, there is a movie that just came out on Netflix called Born on the 4th of July. And if you are one of the people that continues to rag on Tom Cruise and you have not seen that movie, I would say save your money. Do not see The Mummy, but see that movie. You owe it to yourself to see that movie because I maintain that Tom Cruise is actually a very talented actor, and that movie specifically, I probably think about that movie like every day, honestly. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's that's a great Tom Cruise performance. Like Magnolia is a great Tom Cruise performance.
Yeah, so that's what I would say. I don't want to just harp on how bad Tom Cruise is. Like there's a lot of good stuff.
I don't think that this is his fault.
No, absolutely.
He's a very physical performer. Sophia Boutelle is a very physical performer, and one of the things I will credit the film is that there's a lot of CGI stuff, but when it comes to the action scenes, it's not, you know, it's not like how Van Helsing came down to a fight between two CGI characters instead of a fight between Hugh Jackman and then the guy who played Dracula. There is an actual fight between Sophia Boutella and Tom Cruise. It's not great action, but it's action. They perhaps did not use the physicality of those actors to their best, but at least there was some gravitas to it. It wasn't CGI garbage, which I think a lot of these movies end up dissenting into. I would say wait until this shows up on Netflix to see The Mummy. I think it's like a good, it's like a fine like sort of afternoon movie if you're just looking for something to watch. It's mildly entertaining, and if this is like kind of the Man of Steel of the Dark Universe, and eventually we get like a Wonder Woman in terms of like whether it's Bride of Frankenstein or whether it's any of these other movies that they're working on, you know, Invisible Man, Dracula, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if that leads to them learning lessons from this and taking it and making better movies.
Then fine. Yes, right. It'll be worth it.
Yeah. I think we'll wrap it up there. With our review of The Mummy, obviously not as receptive as our review of Wonder Woman last week. But Vince, perhaps to wrap up, can you tell people maybe where they can find more of your work as a filmmaker, or maybe just get in touch with you?
So I'm on Facebook if you want to look me up, Vince Masson, and I also have a Vimeo account, but I can't remember my. How to reach me on that. So when I come back for a future show, I'll definitely have more.
Can you search Vic Masson on Vimeo?
I believe you can.
Yeah. Yes. So well, that's we've given people a head start then.
Definitely.
I write about movies, TV shows, and other nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com, and I will be back here on CFRU on Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.